weekend that we spent together back in February, believe it or not. It's already 5 months ago, I think. Time flies. But many of you weren't, and we didn't spend the whole weekend just looking at Proverbs 31. I think it only came up just briefly during one of our little sessions together. But it is an interesting chapter because it's a chapter that I would venture to say, if I asked for a raise of hands, you know, where have we most often heard Proverbs 31 referenced? Most of the time, it tends to come up and be referenced in ladies' Bible studies. You know, the Proverbs 31 woman. It's kind of, it seems to almost exclusively get relegated to that kind of context. It's a passage of Scripture that, for whatever reason, over time has been seen as being almost entirely addressed to women. And in some of the material that's produced on this subject, it's not only is it entirely directed to women, but to be quite frank with you, some of it is actually so discouraging that it's no surprise that some women don't ever want to hear another sermon on Proverbs 31 or ever read another Bible study on Proverbs 31, because it's written in such a way, it's kind of like, you know, this is what every woman has to somehow or another magically be, you know, six months after marriage. It's like Proverbs 31 is this picture of kind of the day in the life of a godly woman, which is incredibly discouraging, especially when you read the verses and you realize that this woman, you know, she gets up before daylight, she doesn't go to bed until after dark, and you know, she buys land, she sells property, she makes things to sell to the merchant, she makes clothes for her kids, she feeds her family, she does a ladies' Bible study, and she does all of that in one day. It's like, if this is a day in the life of a godly woman, this is superwoman at best, and it's impossible as well. So when the passage is used in that way, or I should say in many cases misused in that way, it becomes, frankly, unhelpful and not what the passage was originally intended to be. I mean, you think about it for a moment as we've gone through Proverbs. We've said this over and over again, that the primary person, the main target audience for Proverbs has been a young man. So for 30 chapters, Proverbs has been focused on training and equipping, bringing up a young man that he might be prepared for life, particularly a young man who would be prepared for leadership and prepared for marriage. So it'd be incredibly odd to have a book that, you know, 30 out of 31 chapters were primarily direct teaching to a young man, but then the last chapter would be a chapter directed to ladies. That would be kind of strange. You wouldn't expect to find that in most books. And throughout the book, actually, never once are daughters directly addressed. Daughters are included in some of the discussions in the earlier chapters, but it's the phrase "my son" that's mentioned 22 times in the book. Another factor to just recognize, these are more just things to observe in the context, in chapter 31, it tells us who is this teaching coming from? Well, actually, the source of the teaching is a little bit twofold. It says here it's the words of King Lemuel, but notice what it says. It's an oracle that his mother taught him. So the context tells us that this chapter is actually teaching from a mother to a son. That doesn't surprise us. We would expect to find teaching to a son in the book of Proverbs. So we find in the context itself, in the book as a whole and in the chapter as a whole, that what we're about to read is primarily originally intended as teaching that would be received by, heard by, a young man. Now, that's, again, very different than what is often referred to when looking at this passage. And what we're going to see is, it's not that there aren't applications to women. Of course there are. When we look at the last part, especially the poem in verses 10 to 31, there are wonderful applications to ladies, to wives, to young women, and old women alike. And yet, again, by seeing that as application, it helps us to not make that the primary focus. It helps us to see that actually how it all fits together as a whole. Let me suggest, as we get started into this passage, again, as I even in my prayer mentioned, that marriage today, in my lifetime, and I'm not that old, young people, but frankly, even in my adult years, marriage has so rapidly become the battleground of Christianity. I mean, I just amazed, you know, with every 6 months, every year, just how rapidly some other significant, huge issue of moral decline comes into our culture that essentially attacks the very fabric of marriage. Marriage has now become one of the most significant countercultural experiences that a Christian can ever participate in. I'm going to be doing a wedding in Auckland just in a couple of weeks, and I just think, you know, to actually be a Christian wedding has now become like one of the most countercultural events that you can be a part of. To actually get a bunch of people to gather in one place and to put a man and a woman in front of a crowd and to stand up before God and all these witnesses and say, God has designed marriage from the beginning to be between one man and one woman for one lifetime, is now suddenly radical. It wasn't that long ago where it was like, yeah, of course, that's just common sense. You know, our world is now determined, it seems, to destroy what God had designed to be both very good and very beautiful. Here's a quote before we get into the actual text. And I just want to help us, because what we're going to read here, what we're going to discover here, is not what our world would teach us. It's not what television's going to teach you. It's not what movies are going to teach you. It's not what anything in this culture is going to present to us. When it comes to understanding God's design for husband and wife relationship and marriage that we're going to learn from this passage, this couldn't be more different than the world in which we live. Tim Keller has written a book on marriage called The Meaning of Marriage, extremely helpful book. He says in their little section, he says, never before in history has there been a society filled with people so idealistic in what they are seeking in a spouse? Both men and women today see marriage not as a way of creating character and community, but as a way to reach personal life goals. A marriage based not on self-denial, but on self-fulfillment will require a low or no maintenance partner who meets your needs while making almost no claims on you. Simply put, today people are asking far too much in the marriage partner. You never marry the right person. I mean, that phrase alone is frankly so radical today that if most young people before they get married could just memorize that. You never marry the right person. The Christian answer to this is that no two people are compatible. The assumption is that there is someone just right for us to marry, and that if we look closely enough, we will find the right person. This moral assumption overlooks a crucial aspect of marriage. It fails to appreciate the fact that we always marry the wrong person. The primary problem is learning how to love and care for the stranger to whom you find yourself married. Marriage brings you into more intense proximity to another human being than any other relationship can. Therefore, the moment you marry someone, you and your spouse begin to change in profound ways, and you can't know ahead of time what those changes will be. So you don't know. You can't know who your spouse will actually be in the future until you get there. Let's read Proverbs 31. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to the one who is perishing and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. An excellent wife who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maids. She considers a field and buys it, and with fruit of her hands she plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. She's not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed in scarlet. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchants. Strength and dignity are her clothing. She laughs at them. She laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. So what's going on in this chapter? And again, as you see, I'm taking the whole chapter, I understand, to be teaching from King Lemuel's mother. Not just the first part, the poem is included. The entire portion of this chapter, from verse 1 all the way to verse 31, is meant to be seen as a combined unit. And it's actually very structurally significant. In verse 3, verse 2 is basically introduction. King Lemuel is basically, again, like we were familiar with, the mother's getting her son's attention. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing? Listen to what I'm going to tell you. And in verse 3, she begins to speak, essentially giving the content of her instruction. Verse 3 is a command, and it's a negative command. Don't give your strength to women and your ways to those who will destroy kings. So in verse 3, she's instructing her son not to do something. Don't give your strength to women. It's extremely significant to see that, first of all, there's a contrast. In verses 10 to 31, you have the contrast. The poem that we're very familiar with, Who Can Find an Excellent Wife, is actually in contrast to verse 3. Verse 3 is, don't give your strength to women. Verse 10 in the poem is, who can find an excellent wife? So wife is singular, women is plural. An excellent or virtuous wife is actually the same word that's used in verse 3 that's translated strength. So to be consistent, I'll just say, I'm going to use the same words. Don't give your virtue to women in the plural, but in contrast, can you find a singular virtuous woman? See, that's the contrast. You have two sections to this. Verse 3, don't give your virtue to the plurality of women, for that will destroy your life and destroy your kingship. Instead, which we'll look at more detail soon, can you find a woman of virtue? Don't give your virtue to women, plurality of women, because they'll destroy your life. Find a virtuous woman, and she will actually strengthen your life. This makes perfect sense. Again, this is instruction to a young man. This is the end of the book of Proverbs. Throughout the book of Proverbs, Solomon has been teaching his son how to pursue wisdom and at the same time how to pursue the kind of woman that he ought to marry. And essentially what we find at the conclusion of the whole book is he kind of draws all this together in this great picture of, if you will avoid the plurality of women out there who will actually drain your virtue, steal your strength, destroy your life, instead be a man of integrity who throughout your whole life, whether you are married or when you are married, you are a one-woman kind of man. You are focused and committed to, you are a man of integrity when it comes to your relationship with other women. You're not pursuing women in the plural. You're not giving your life and your strength and your virtue to any and every woman that comes along the way. But your aim, your focus, your desire, your intent is on one woman. You may not be married. You may not be married for many years. And yet, are you a man of integrity when it comes to your relationship with women? Are you a one-woman kind of man? Are you a man who is focused on honoring God in your relationship with women? Or are you caught up in even our cultural expectations that, frankly, women in relationships and is something to be played with and tested and tried out? It's like buying a car. Who would buy a car unless you test drive it first? I remember getting told that when I was single and thinking about marriage. Well, you wouldn't buy a car unless you test drive. How can you marry a girl? This is nonsense. This isn't God's way. This isn't God's word. If you are married, are you a man who is, we're going to talk about this more specifically in the second half, in verses 10 and following, but are we, again, a man who's giving ourselves to one woman, not to women in the plural? So the first instruction is avoid giving your strength, your virtue, avoid giving your life to the plurality of women, which are ways that will actually destroy you. They'll destroy your life. They'll destroy your leadership. In this context, speaking again to one who would soon be king. Remember the book. Remember the overarching author of the book is a man who actually did just this. Right? He gave his strength and his virtue to women in the plural. And what happened to Solomon? It destroyed his life. It brought about to the destruction of the kingdom itself. Verses 4 to 7 is another negative command. It's not for kings, O Lemuel, it's not for kings to drink strong wine, for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what they have decreed and pervert the rights of the afflicted. Verses 4 to 7 is another negative. It's actually repeated twice, and it's to avoid something, and particularly it's to avoid those things that will actually impair your judgment. Avoid strong drink. Avoid strong wine. It doesn't say here that a king should never have a drink. It says here that kings should avoid strong drink that will impair their, they will impair their judgment. That's specifically the context. Lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. A king's job, a leader's role, is actually to stand in the place of those who are weak. They are to be there to be able to give sound judgment, to be somebody who can be trusted, that they will evaluate and judge and determine and decree what is right and good. They won't pervert justice, but they'll do what is right so that those people who are under their care will be able to safely trust in their leadership and their decision-making and their discernment. And the mother is quite wise in teaching her son, who will soon be in a power of authority and position, who will have access to, frankly, who knows what. She's essentially telling, don't allow yourself to take advantage of the what might be accessible to you, but by taking advantage of those things will actually put you in a place where you will be, your judgment will be impaired. You'll not be one who will actually rule wisely. You'll pervert justice, and you'll actually afflict those people who you are meant to protect. You see, so the first two commands of the mother, the first two parts of her instruction are negative. Avoid women, the plurality of women, that will, if you give your strength and virtue to them, your life and your kingdom will be destroyed. And avoid taking into your mouth, literally, drink, that will actually impair your judgment, that will make you, frankly, incapable of being a trustworthy, consistent, just leader. Again, none of us in this room are kings that I'm aware of, or nor shall we be. And yet, all of us, particularly men, we are put in a position by God to lead others, to lead our wives, to lead our children, to lead our families. And if this instruction may not be on us for as far as overarching kingship, but it's certainly applicable to us as far as leading in our homes. We must be men who are leading, who are not indulging in our life anything and everything that would actually impair our judgment or distract us from our primary responsibility of actually leading our families and our homes. The world is desperate for men to stand up and take leadership and actually show that they are willing to actually take a bullet, whether it be literally or figuratively, for their families, for their society, and for our culture. And yet so many men are inebriated and distracted by the things of this world. And if it isn't strong drink, it's video games. If it isn't alcohol or drugs, it's some other mind-numbing nonsense that essentially takes men out of the position of leadership. They are not even capable of actually standing up and leading and making decisions with integrity, with boldness, because their minds are so completely numbed by the distractions and entertainment of this world that they are no longer fit to lead anybody, let alone a home, a family, or in the workplace. You see, wisdom would tell us, God's word would tell us, and the instructions we're even learning here in this past, Lemuel's mother, whoever she was from ancient times past, is telling us, listen, you're going to be a leader. Don't give yourself to those things that will actually completely numb your mind and distract you so profoundly that you can't actually lead. You can't care for those people who are under your protection. So the first two commands, verse 3, things to avoid, verses 4 to 7, things to avoid. But then the mother turns to positive commands. The first positive instruction in verses 8 and 9. So if we're not supposed to give ourselves in the plurality to a plurality of women, what are we supposed to do? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. If we're not supposed to put into our mouths or into our lives those things that will actually impair our leadership, what are we supposed to do? Well, verses 8 to 9 tells us what we're supposed to do. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. You see the contrast. The contrast is between verses 4 and 7, which is the negative. Don't drink, don't put things into your life that make you incapable of leading, incapable of defending the weak. Instead, because of your position of leadership, make sure that you are in a position where you will speak rightly and justly, where what comes out of your mouth will be righteous judgment, so that you can actually defend the rights of those who are weak and helpless. See, the contrast is here. Don't do this. Don't allow your life to become basically so useless that you can't lead. Instead, be deliberately putting yourself in a place where you are able to lead with boldness, with righteous judgment. Open your mouth. Open your mouth, judge rightly, defend the rights of the poor and needy. Again, this is not that it's not that these points don't have application to ladies, and yet in all of time and in our generation, certainly, I don't apologize for being extremely forthright with young men, that it's about time that they stand up and take responsibility. We are again, our generation is desperate for young men who will be leaders. Young men who will actually take the responsibility that God has placed on them in whatever capacity that is. That could be in their school, it could be in their home, it could be in their job, and someday it may be in their family and it may be in greater areas of circles of influences. I have no idea, but if it doesn't start somewhere, it's not going to start. God's called each and every one of us as men to lead in some capacity. And this passage very clearly shows this is a responsibility God has given. And we may not be kings, but we will, by God's grace, have an opportunity to lead and influence others to some extent. What's in contrast, though, with the first negative instruction? I've already mentioned it and alluded to it, but it's significant to see how these fit together. Verse 3, don't give your virtue to women. Okay, but what am I supposed to do? Well, I've already mentioned it. Well, what we're supposed to do is in verses 10 and following. We're supposed to instead try to find a virtuous wife. Okay, but that's a bit of a open-ended thing too. What do you mean try to find a virtuous wife? Some of us are, well, first of all, maybe you're already married. Secondly, it's like, well, I'm not even interested in that right now. Or thirdly, it's kind of like, well, tell me where I can find one. And that's the problem, actually, in some sense, because when we read this, an excellent wife, a virtuous wife who can find. We read that as kind of our idea of finding things, which is basically kind of like you lost your car keys, I can't find them, and you just kind of rummage around until you hope you stumble across them, and oh, there they are, look what I found. And we kind of, if we're not careful, we can think about this passage or that question in the same way. It can kind of be like, oh, this is a passage for young guys, and if you're not married yet, basically it's just kind of like go through life and just, you know, just keep your eyes open, and as soon as you find a virtuous woman, grab her and marry her, because that's what you're supposed to be doing. The problem, of course, is, and again, think about Proverbs as a whole. That doesn't really make sense with Proverbs. Nowhere in Proverbs do you get the impression that something worth having is just kind of stumbled upon by accident. Right? Throughout a whole book of Proverbs, we're told, right, you're to pursue wisdom. You're to search for it like hidden treasure. You're to value it more than you would gold and jewels and costly diamonds. Wisdom, the wisdom of God, the thing that we're supposed to give our life to pursue more than anything else in this world, is never in Proverbs presented as something you just kind of accidentally stumble across. It's actually something that's supposed to be deliberately sought after, pursued in some way. So certainly when this question is asked, an excellent wife who can find, it can't mean an excellent wife who can you just kind of accidentally stumble across one day, and when you do, grab her and marry her. That doesn't work. Now, it could mean who can you deliberately pursue. In other words, who can you deliberately focus pursuit? You're going to value treasure. It's going to become your life's pursuit in that kind of sense. Because that's very consistent with Proverbs. We would pursue, actively, diligently, give ourselves to pursuing this thing of excellent value. That would actually be quite consistent in Proverbs. And the idea, of course, is when you find that thing, not because you're just accidentally hoping you'll stumble across it, but because you're actually actively engaged in pursuing this thing, when you find it, make sure you grab a hold of it. Make sure you keep it. That would make sense in Proverbs, but it doesn't make sense for the poem. Because the woman we read about in verses 10 to 31 isn't a newlywed. This isn't the picture of a girl on her wedding day. This isn't who can find an excellent wife, and when you find her, marry her. This guy didn't find this girl when he married her. I mean, think about it. When we read the poem, this girl's got, she's got children. She's old enough to be seen as a woman in the community. She's teaching others in verse 26. She's obviously incredibly capable. She's got lots of life experience as far as issues regarding, you know, financial dealings. This isn't a newlywed. This isn't a young bride. This is a woman who's mature, both in life and marriage. This isn't somebody that the young guy just, you know, he actively pursued, and when he found her, he married her. Something else going on here. And it's actually another way that in the Bible, at least, the word find is sometimes used. The word find in the Bible, and particularly in Judges chapter 14, verse 12, it's used this way. It's the idea that you're responsible to actually develop, to seek to develop the thing you're looking for. In other words, the thing you're looking for, it's not that it doesn't exist. All of the kind of raw material is there. In Judges 14:12, it's actually the idea of a riddle. Samson tells a riddle. The answer to the riddle is known, but you have to try to work it out. In this case, you get married. The idea of what God has for your wife is known, but you have the responsibility to work it out, to find her, to develop her, to seek to basically take the raw materials that God gives you in your newlywed wife and to help to mold her and shape her to become the kind of virtuous woman God has designed her to be. You see, the idea here of find, it does involve pursuit. It does involve deliberate effort. It does involve being actively engaged in the process of finding. But the process of finding here is a lifelong development of seeing this wife, who she can't be this kind of woman on her wedding day. But she, by God's grace, will grow into this kind of woman throughout her married life. And here's the key thing, guys, because she's married to you. Because you are actively finding her. Because you are deliberately seeking to help her to grow into the kind of woman God has called her to be. You are a man of integrity. You are seeking to lead her in all of these areas, helping her to grow in her gifts, helping her to be more and more enabled to be the kind of woman that's described in verses 10 to 31. The description here is the description in some sense of kind of an idealistic picture. Not the day in the life of a woman. That's not even possible. But as a woman grows throughout her life and she grows in godliness, this in some sense is like what basically God has handed you men the blueprint. And he simply said, listen, you, by God's grace, avoid giving your virtue to women, but give your life to the woman that God has given you in marriage and help find her, help develop her, help her to grow to become this kind of woman. So seeing the chapter as a whole helps us to see that this isn't some kind of random tag-on poem at the end of Proverbs that, you know, is really great for women's Bible studies. This is actually an amazing chapter of actually showing that at the culmination of the whole book of Proverbs, which has been all about training and equipping a young man to grow in wisdom so that he can be prepared for both leadership and marriage, he gets to the end of the book and it's kind of like, this is it, man. This is it. Taking everything that we've talked about, everything that we learned, now you take that and you apply that to the most important and significant relationship that you'll ever have in life, and that is your responsibility to your wife in marriage. Now, there's another aspect to this, though, because if you read the poem, verses 10 to 31, which I've already read through once, I think some of you may already know this, the poem is sometimes is referred to as an acrostic poem. What that means, you lose it in the English, but what that means is every verse in Proverbs 31, verses 10 to 31, each verse starts with a different letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So it's amazingly well structured. It's very purposefully written. And here's the hint. If you come across an acrostic poem, you know right away that the poem has some purpose and structure. I mean, you try that in English sometime. Try writing a 21-verse poem. Actually, just try that. That would probably hurt most of our heads. But then try writing a 21-verse long poem where every line starts with the next letter of the English alphabet. And then try doing it in a way that you actually have words that make sense and communicate something of, you know, helpful. That's hard work. Nobody does that just on accident. And so when you come across that, you know that, wait a minute, there's something unique about the structure of this. This isn't just kind of a random collection of thoughts. And what's significant is if you lay out the poem in kind of its themes, you find that there's actually kind of repeating themes. There's at the beginning and end, the woman is praised. In the next two sections, you find the work of the woman is described. You find the woman giving wisdom and the woman who is very confident. You find these contrasts going throughout the poem. But in the center of the poem, there's actually a verse that kind of stands out as just out of place. And that's verse 23. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. You see, you can almost see this poem laid out kind of in two columns. Verses 10 to 22 is one column. Verses 24 to 31 is the other column. But verse 23 is just in the middle. It doesn't actually have anything that compares to. It's kind of weird. It's out of place. Everything describes the woman. Everything describes the woman. And then you got this one statement about the husband in the middle. Like, what in the world is going on there? Was she just kind of running out of ideas? And in her acrostic, it's kind of, oh, what starts with that letter? I'll throw this one in there. No. What she's doing in this poem is she's showing, listen, this woman, as the woman has grown and as she's developed in her life as a godly woman, see what's at the center of her life? What's at the center of her focus is what? Is her husband. See, what's at the center of the husband's life is his wife. Because he is finding her, he is giving his life to develop her. What's at the center of the wife is the husband. When it says here that the husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land, this isn't, you know, the wife is doing all the work and the husband's watching rugby with the guys. By saying the husband's known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land, the husband is a known leader in his community. To sit at the gates with the elders is to basically be in a position of authority within his town, within his city. And essentially what this poem is demonstrating is that as the wife gives her life for the good of her husband, the husband is blessed and strengthened. He is actually enabled to become the kind of man God wants him to be because of the wife's ministry and service to him. You see, what we have in this chapter is a very unique and creative way of actually describing what God has intended marriage to be. God has intended marriage to be a relationship between a man and a woman who would have their lives so completely satisfied in Christ that they would willingly give their lives entirely for the benefit of the other, so that the other person might be more and more like Christ. You see, there's nothing in this poem that lends itself to selfishness. The husband is not a selfish husband because he's entirely giving his life for the benefit of the wife. His whole life is given to help her grow and become the kind of woman God would want her to be. The wife here is anything but selfish. Her entire life is given so that the husband might become more and more what God would want him to be. What you have in this poem and this entire chapter is a picture of everything kept in perspective. You've got a wife and a man, a husband and a wife, who are entirely giving of themselves for the good of the other person. Everything that the wife does and accomplishes is for the good of her husband. Everything the husband does is so that his wife might grow to become more and more like Christ. You know, and the reality is this, that this shouldn't surprise us. If we're thinking about marriage like the world does, this is ridiculous. I mean, I thought marriage was about getting my needs met. I thought marriage was about basically marrying somebody who will help me be more successful in my life, or basically, you know, again, satisfying me or helping, you know, upping my kind of status. In our world, marriage is all about me, me, me. But in the Bible, of course, this makes perfect sense. Marriage is not about me. It's not even about you. It's about Christ. Marriage is never about us. Marriage has always been about Christ. Marriage has been designed by God to picture the relationship that Christ has with his church. Ephesians chapter 5 tells us that was the eternal purposes of God, and that it can only be pictured if you have a marriage that's made up of a man and a woman. And even more significantly for this context, it's made up of a man and a woman who are so completely determined to live their lives for the good of the other person that they're willing to sacrifice everything of who they are, everything that they wish they had, everything that they wanted and desired. They will give all of that willingly and joyfully so that their spouse can become all that God has desired and created him or her to be. You see, it's no surprise at all that in Proverbs we would find a picture of marriage that would look a lot like the relationship between Christ and his church. A willing sacrifice for the good of the other and a joyful service in response to that sacrifice. That's what our marriages are meant to picture. And that's not something that was just made up by Paul. That's something that's actually been outlined by God from creation and discussed and explained and elaborated on throughout all kinds of word pictures and descriptions throughout the entire Bible. You see, what we find in Proverbs is an incredible picture of a husband and wife, that they promote one another, they support one another, they help one another, they sacrifice for one another, they care for one another, they depend upon one another, and in reality, their entire life is actually lived for the benefit of the other, for the glory of God, so that Christ would be magnified. No surprise as well that when we get to the end of the poem, you know, what does this result in? It results in a home that's filled with joy and praise. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. These are wonderful verses, but this is a home that's filled with joy and praise. There's no apology for the joy and the praise that is received and given. And in verse 31, her fruit of her hands, let her works be praised in the gates. How are her works being praised in the gates? Remember who's in the gates? The husband, right? He's in the gates. That's how her works are being praised in the gates. Because why? He goes to the gates and he's like, you know what? There's no way I could be the kind of man I am except for the wife that God's given me. And she's doing the same. And you have a wonderful, glorious picture of a marriage as God has intended and designed it to be. The problem, of course, as we close, is we recognize, everybody in this room recognizes, that sounds great. But I know myself well enough to know that I can't do that. None of us can on our own. And yet the hope, of course, is if that is what God has designed marriage to be, and that if that is what God has intended Christian marriages to resemble, then God has also promised by his grace to enable us to live our lives in our marriages in a way that would honor and glorify him. And when we know our failings, and when we're intimately and acutely aware of our failings, we run to Christ, we seek forgiveness, and we continue to pursue our responsibility in our marriage in a way that will honor and glorify him. Let's close in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you.